Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got filmmaker Oliver Scott with me. Hey, Oliver.
Good afternoon.
All right, we're actually in person, which is cool because it's always fun to be in person instead of on Zoom. We just did an interview episode. That's the one before this, where we talked all about his film and music video and art film, The Sword That Waits. It was in both Filmvasion LA and Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2021 and took home awards in both, including the Grand Jury Award for Best Music Video.
Thanks very much. Sherman Oaks,
right, last November. And proud to say this beautiful work of art is in the Discover Indie Film TV series on Amazon Prime Video. I'm doing a good job of being a pitch man right now. So go to season 5, episode 8. Just go to Amazon Prime Video any way you can, but hopefully on a nice big screen, and search for Discover Indie Film. And there's 5 seasons. And in this most recent season that hopefully hit the airwaves in late March, season 5, episode 8. There's 10 episodes, and there's all good films in there. It's stuff handpicked from the festival circuit. But this podcast is going to be Oliver answering the Discover Indie Film 4 questions, which are favorite films of all time, a film that's underrated, a film that's overrated, and a lesser-known film that people should seek out. And so I am going to get to shut up and just let you start answering. All right, Oliver, favorites.
I got a couple of easy ones for top three. Heat, which is just a personal favorite and a bit of a holy text for me. That's embarrassing to admit, but instead of a Bible or something, when I was growing up, I had crime movies, and that was kind of like the king of crime movies because it has a kind of juvenile kind of zen to it, which I found instead of religion as a teenager. And I'm having to unlearn at this point. Blade Runner, another easy one, but got to be honest. In terms of movies I could watch or quote or draw random frames of or wrap around me like a pleasant blanket or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason it's on a lot of people's lists is because it's really just, it's wonderful work. It's beautiful art.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And
same with Heat. Both films are wonderful films, but I mean, Blade Runner is real special.
I think it is. And obviously it's got no shortage of analysis or whatnot, but just got to be honest about my top three is one of the first movies that I, you know, watched more than one time. It was kind of like I felt like a member of my family. That movie did. And number three, I want to go with All Is Full of Love by Björk, which is a music video directed by Chris Cunningham, which is one of my favorite pieces of motion picture, period. It's one of the coolest looking things I've ever seen. It kind of set the look for robotics and the future for pretty much everything that came after about, I don't know, 2001 or something. But the whole white robot, kind of white skinned robot look kind of comes from this one video. These robots were developed by Stanley Kubrick for AI when he was making AI. Sort of fell out of his hands and back into the hands of the music video director. And it's a really neat, angelic representation of this kind of robotic savior, Björk, and her idea of this kind of Android heaven, and everything's like very sterile and kind of stark and beautiful.
Very cool. You know what? I haven't seen it. I'm gonna have to look it up. I'm sure it's online, so
it is.
I'll take a look. I'm actually a big. I don't even know if I said this to you in the previous chat, but yeah, I've always, because of I was at the right age, I mean, I was hitting puberty when MTV launched, so I just see music videos a wonderful art form.
Me too.
And yeah, I'm glad you have a music video on your list.
Yeah, I believe in them. I still believe in them. I still like them. That particular one is on a DVD called The Works of, I think it's called The Works of the Director, I think is the name of the series. Yeah. It's put out by Palm Pictures. There's a Chris Cunningham volume. There's a Michel Gondry volume. There's a Jonathan Glazer, Mark Romanek. There's another volume that had a couple other, Stefan Sednawi and the Dutch guy that used to shoot Depeche Mode. His name I'm blanking, but it was a great series of compilations of the works of these directors, and it has their commercials, music videos, their shorts. The works of the director, I think it's called.
It's interesting because yeah, you make me think when you name those names that for a long time I felt like some of the best filmmakers features started in a music video, and I think for obvious reasons of just learning to have your own style, because right, a music video director needs to have a visual style that people hire you to do.
I'd say that's still the case. There's still amazing music video directors out there, animated and live action. Some of these people go on to, you know, have like feature careers or things like that. Most of these are names people don't know because I don't know why, because we have devalued this stuff in this country. But anyway, All Is Full of Love, Chris Cunningham, pretty much anything Chris Cunningham does.
Under, very cool. Well, question number two is a film you think is underrated.
Yeah. So this was honestly, it was hard for me to come up with just one answer for all these, but I will.
Okay, you can do more. You
know, okay.
My big joke is there's no one. There's no whistle. I'm not going to blow a whistle if you name two films.
Oh, okay. Okay. Then I would say for the main one, just because I don't think I've ever heard this really talked about, but so The Hunger is known as this, you know, stylish vampire movie with David Bowie, and is known and is usually referred to as being cool looking and stylish and all that, but it never gets talked about as the template for Blade Runner. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone talk about this, but it was just something I noticed when I was watching The Hunger recently. And maybe it's because I have this over-familiarity with Blade Runner. Maybe I'm seeing things that aren't there, but I think I'm not. I think I'm seeing things that are there. But basically, I think Blade Runner is like, it's a brother move. You know, it's like...
Yeah, for those who don't know, The Hunger is Tony Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
In early 80s.
Yeah, I think 82,
Yeah, 82, 83. And Blade Runner was...
It was Ridley. I think younger brother. It seems like a younger brother type of move as a younger brother.
But I mean, those two, very openly collaborators. And
rivals.
And rivals, yeah.
Or, pushing each other. Competitors, you know. They're definitely competitors. And it definitely feels like a... All you can do that, I can do that too, kind of thing. There's shot selection, lens stuff, audio stuff he's doing with the mix, and how there's these like chiming sounds, the unmotivated, you know, reflections off of stuff. It's so many of the things you like about Blade Runner are in The Hunger first, and I thought, why does this never get talked about? You know, there's so much analysis on Blade Runner, and it just never gets talked about other than, oh, he's got this brother and he's making movies also, but he's trying to make his brother's movies. He's trying to like out-style his brother.
Interesting. And maybe he did, but you make me think that the casting of Bowie, which I was a huge fan. I was a huge Bowie fan, and I loved The Hunger is something we watched over and over on VHS in high school for me. And but yeah, Bowie kind of distracts you, I think. Like, it makes you think of it as like, because there's a handful of films that I love almost solely because Bowie's in it. But like,
I think that's why most people know that movie. I think him being in it distracts it from all its other qualities.
Yeah.
You know, it's known more as this curiosity of Bowie rather than like a style template.
But a great film. I remember loving that film.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one in the history of Blade Runner. I was also going to talk about how not all the recent reboots were shitty, or at least
for sure some of them are underrated, right?
You know, it was easy to kind of like just plow everything that came out, you know, under the judgment of like none of these things should exist and they're all shitty. But I was just going to mention about how there were some decent ideas in the RoboCop reboot, which is an easily forgettable, you know, movie that has, it does have things about it that are not good, truly, but it also has some decent ideas, which I don't think will ever get acknowledged. Not that you need to go out and see it because it's kind of for purists only, I guess, but
I don't know. I wouldn't mind watching it. I admit I missed it.
There's some decent ideas, you know, like I think they can't do what the original did because we're all so desensitized to violence and don't really know what satire is anymore, but there's some decent ideas.
Lord knows it's a different time for Verhoeven style ultraviolence. Oh, yeah. It's a different climate.
Like, what do you? Society's kind of made that stuff obsolete.
Got another reboot. It's funny because you make me think a really good friend of mine. His underrated is the all women's Ghostbusters. He's like everyone judged it as like a stunt casting thing, but he's like, it's a really good movie.
Yeah, I was that like, being
damn
okay.
It, I didn't see it.
I remember it being all right. Like, anything that's bad about it is only bad because it's bad, not because the idea is bad. Like, if a bad joke is a bad joke, it's not because there's a woman telling the joke. You know what I mean? The bad joke is a bad joke. Because it's a bad joke.
Well, those are some super talented women. Anyway, when you talked about reboots, I thought of that.
Let Me In, I think, is an underrated.
Right, the remake. Let Me In, the American version?
Yeah, the
of Let the Right One In?
Exactly. As someone that grew up in New Mexico, I think he's got a really good handle on New Mexico, specifically the alien lunar isolation of like northern New Mexico, like Los Alamos, where it's set. He seemed to have to well relate the experience of growing up there. Like, really got the feeling that he was transmitting a lived experience. His sense of just like how strange and like lonely New Mexico is. Was something that I don't think that never really got talked about that movie. It's just good. Also, it's just good.
Cool. All right. Well, you want to?
they do it. He does a neat Manhunter quote in that. So like, you know, in Manhunter, like the killer has this big moon poster on his wall, which is supposed to indicate that the character is just like not on this earth, and he's kind of an alien, and he's very stark, and he's just in this kind of cold atmosphere mentally, and they do that with this little kid in Let Me In. They give him the moon poster, and it imparts that same feeling of like isolation to the kid, who in this case is the victim of bullying and not the bully himself. So Matt Reeves is a great referencer of other films. It doesn't feel like Tarantino. Nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't feel like that style of quoting feels like the way that you incorporate films into your life. Let me in.
Excellent. And next question in number three is overrated.
Yeah, overrated. I'm gonna say JFK and the entire works of Oliver Stone. That's what I'm going for.
I'm actually with you big time on that. I mean, sometimes he came up with something that I kind of liked, but most of his films,
I mean, I say they're overrated because JFK gets treated like it's a historical document, or like, you know, this expose of the truth, or, you know, opening people's eyes. And it, like, I don't know if you've seen that movie recently, but it reads like, I don't know, like Mike Lindell with a budget or something.
Yeah, well, he is so... I mean, he has a point of view, but almost all his films that are based on something historical or something real, based on a true story, I feel like he should have changed the names and admitted that this is fiction. Because it is. Like, I'm like, just stop already. Rename it. This is, you are writing fiction. You're right. You're just bullshitting us to tell a good story. Or to tell your story. And so just fucking rename them. that's my cross to bear. I feel especially that way actually about quite a few things these days. But, you know, in a world where you can look up the truth, like, why he's a propagandist.
I mean... It's the separate question of why say something is true, you know, like what do you hope to get by saying something is true? I don't know.
All right. Well, there's only one more left. That's a lesser known film that people should seek out.
Again, hard to come up with just one, but my number one, I'm going to say The Red Turtle, which is a recent French animated film, which is very naturalistic and kind of a slow, quiet, magical realism story that's beautifully animated and is kind of in the tradition of these French guys like Hergé and kind of get illustrated Tintin, or Tintin as we know it here. And it's really beautiful. It's really well animated. It's very quiet and transcendent. It's got great music. It's just a treat. You can see it on the Netflix. I figure fewer people would actually be likely to have seen that one, whereas these other ones.
Oh, particularly foreign language films, even animation.
Nice thing about this
people
one.
People tend not to see it.
Yeah. I think the fact it was French, I don't know, it might have turned people off, but there's no dialogue in the film, so it doesn't matter in the end. It's
very cool.
It's a very, like, universal type story.
Sounds like something up my alley.
It's amazing. The French can really animate. Like there's a culture that has really valued, you know, artisanship and craftsmanship. And
oh yeah, I go way back. Well, I am not a connoisseur at all, but we're fans of Fantastic Planet.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
that's, you know, amazing.
It's an amazing film. It's just so weird too. I love it.
My grandma took me to see that when I was a young kid. That was very, very made a big impression on me. Yeah, good on her for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just going to mention these real quick because they're lesser known and I want people to see them. The Last Minute. Okay, so Stephen Norrington. This was like a post-Fight Club, kind of very Fight Club type of story of a disaffected young kind of like the deficit of identity that the young, you know, young white people, particularly in the creative industries, might have, and like kind of the emptiness of trying to be, I don't know, trying to climb the ladder, be someone. I'd say I kind of got lost in the shadow of Fight Club. It kind of came out around the same time. Stephen Norrington, another former music video guy. The Blood of Heroes.
I don't know The Blood of Heroes.
Which is written and directed by David Peoples, who was one of the screenwriters on Blade Runner. But this was a late 80s post-apocalyptic wasteland sports movie that isn't really about sports, but about kind of like the place that sports has in human society. And the way tribes, I guess. I don't really know what the movie's about. It's in a wasteland. There's a sports game played with a dog skull. Rutger Hauer's in it. It's got great wasteland action if you like that sort of thing.
I mean, you're bringing up interesting topics because Lord knows sports fanship with sports and fanaticism and loyalty to a name or team or the, you know, as stand-up comedians make fun of it, like you're rooting for the shirt because the players rotate so frequently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it is a weird psychological thing, and I hate bringing everything into politics, but like sometimes it just feels like politics. People are just rooting for their team and they're not even caring what it's about.
I think that's its identity. Sports is like I heard someone say the other day that politics is war by other means. I think like you could say the same thing about sports, that sports is, you know, war by other means. It's kind of like what we've figured out to do instead of war.
Right. And right.
Like,
instead of Boston having like 1,000 people grab bats and sticks and go up to New York and try to crack some skulls, you have the Red Sox versus the Yankees.
or like, what if the Olympics, what if we had the Olympics instead of World Wars?
Right.
You know, like what if, you know, your decision to invade this or that country was determined by whether or not we beat you at pole vaulting or something. Like a way that we could symbolically settle these conflicts. And I think that was the original idea behind sport.
Well, for sure. Cool. And actually, yes, we talked about London in the podcast before this one. And, I don't know why I'm going to share this, but I'm pretty sure that the evolution of soccer was from public beheadings, right? And
oh my God, was it?
Yeah, there'd be a public beheading, and then it was a game to kick it into someone else's neighborhood, and then they'd try to kick it back into your neighborhood because no one wanted the decapitated head. And that's why all the football clubs are based on neighborhoods in England.
I had never heard that before. I'd have to check.
I should probably Google it before repeating it. But a huge soccer fan told me that, like, this is how soccer began, kicking around heads. That's why it's Chelsea versus whatever, because, like, you didn't want the head in your neighborhood.
I think maybe the ancient Aztec versions might have started with skulls, you know?
They had their version where they were trying to kick it through a... Kick the ball through a hoop kind of thing. Yeah, it was early basketball or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's kind of a skull-sized little ball they have. I don't know. One last one I'd mention is it's called Final Approach. Again, very underseen. It is kind of like a murder psychological thriller that involves like these Air Force test pilots. There's all this footage from an SR-71 documentary. It's kind of like more about the plane than anything else. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's very atmospheric. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It's very strange. It doesn't really resemble any other movie I've seen.
And you're talking about...
it's called Final Approach.
The 1991?
Yes, that's the one.
With Hector Elizondo?
That's the one.
Yeah. Be careful, people, because the title's been used a lot since then.
Yes.
There's a couple made-for-TV movies. There's some other things. So, right, we're talking about the 1991 film.
It's a great score and sound design movie. It's a great, like, atmospheric... kind of not really about the character type of movie. It's very weird. Feels like a Canadian TV movie or something. It feels unique. Feels very strange. Some of these movies you find because like some electronic musician has sampled them or something, and you trace the samples back and you find these very strange things. That's how I find.
That's a cool way to find a film.
Yeah. Sampling through music has been this kind of reverse gateway to take you to either other forms of music or, you know, sometimes it's movie scores, you know, sometimes it's, you know, some bit of sound design from a movie. Yeah. Final Approach. Check it out.
All right. Final Approach. All right. Excellent. I'm going to wrap this up because we're supposed to not go too long on the four questions episodes. So, first order of business, like and subscribe to this podcast, whatever podcatcher you're using. Be kind. Kindness is a good thing on this planet. If human beings can be kind to each other. And you know what? Giving 5 stars to people, that's a form of kindness. Actually doesn't cost you anything, right? So, as long as I'm talking about 5 stars... you just listened to Oliver Scott answer the Discover Indie Film 4 questions. Why don't you watch his film, The Sword That Waits, on Amazon Prime Video as part of the Discover Indie Film TV series. Why don't you do the extra step of being kind and giving the series 5 stars? Yeah, you just go to Amazon.com, because I think most viewers, you can't, at least I watch on the box I have connected to my TV with Prime. It doesn't let me give 5 stars within the TV.
Okay.
So you gotta make that extra effort and go to Amazon.com, go to the Prime tab or Prime Video tab and give the series 5 stars. In fact, the weird thing is every season is separate. So like season 1 has like X number of stars and then season 5 actually is going to start off with 0. Even though, you know, you think it should be an amalgamation. And you think all the seasons should be added together. So anyway, that's my begging for stars spiel. So give this podcast 5 stars. Give the TV series Discover Indie Film 5 stars. That is on Amazon Prime Video. And now I'll just name some websites so we can get out of here. Actually, if you're interested in Oliver's work, go to oliverscottmotion.com. And if you're interested in Discover Indie Film, this podcast that gave birth to a Amazon Prime TV series, go to discoverindiefilm.com. And if you care about social media, the handle is @DIFWINS. And one last thing is the film festivals that I program. Oliver's film was actually in both. So if you're interested, if you want to go to a film festival in November here in LA, go to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. It's shermanoaksff.com and @shermanoaksff on social media. And every June, we've got Film Invasion LA. That's filminvasionla.com, and it's @filminvasionla on social media. And I'm done.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.